The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
It is Tuesday, June 28th, 2022. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, William Forbath, Associate Dean for Research at the University of Texas at Austin Law School, and Joseph Fishkin, Professor at the UCLA School of Law, authors of The Anti-Oligarchy Constitution, Reconstructing the Economic Foundations of Democracy. Also on the program today, 46 immigrants found dead in an abandoned trailer in San Antonio, 16 more hospitalized. Progressives push the White House to assert itself in the wake of the fall of Roe, and 10 of 13 states' trigger laws banning abortion are now in effect. Meanwhile, the January 6th committee to hold an unscheduled hearing today with Mark Meadows' top aide. Feds, meanwhile, have seized John Eastman, his Trump's coup lawyer's phone. Oh, darn it. It's primary day in Colorado, Illinois, New York, Oklahoma, and Utah. New York is local primaries. The Michigan State Supreme Court voids the indictments of former Governor Snyder and seven others in the Flint water probe. Meanwhile, Russia defaults on its foreign debt and also says that Brittany Griner's trial to start on Friday. And lastly, Rudy Giuliani's back tapper gets a reduced charges after the video emerges. All this and more on today's Majority Report. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. It is Tuesday. Emma Viglin still out. I got an email saying you shouldn't be so hard on her for leaving, for not being. Of course, I'm teasing. Ladies and gentlemen, but
also I'll just speak for myself. We don't notice when Sam's doing that because we're not listening.
That's right. Yeah, no one's paying attention to that. We should say we do have a guest in studio. Oh, we're going to start with the live-in one. We do have a guest in studio today. He may join us on the microphone in the fun half. Right? He's waving. He may or may not. We'll see. Ladies and gentlemen, and pretty exciting guest for the second time in the studio. We generally don't let anybody but VIPs in. So thank you for joining us. Let's get right into it. I should say today's interview pre-recorded, and I think the gist of the book regards the anti-oligarchic nature of the Constitution when folks on the center to the left understand that the Constitution is malleable and it is a function of who the Supreme Court is at any given time. And much of this is about how folks on the left, nominal left, whatever you want to say, the non-Republicans, at least in today's day and age, forgot that for the better part of our history, the Supreme Court was a completely reactionary body and was inhibiting everything most of us would consider to be just and fair. And It was inhibiting a 40-hour work week, a 60-hour work week. It was inhibiting the ability to limit child labor. It was, I mean, we can just go on and on and on. And, but the point is also, it was allowing for poll taxes and literacy tests. It was allowing for the subjugation of women. And the court is returning to its mean. And so with that said, we thought it was a pretty good day to play this interview. What we're seeing now in terms of Roe v. Wade, and it's unclear what the, you know, how sustainable the reaction and the anger, or whether it will grow as more women are subjected to abortion bans and it becomes clearer, the obvious thing becomes clearer, which is if the Republicans take control of government, the presidency, the Senate, and the House, they, unlike the Democrats, will have no compunction in getting rid of the filibuster. They march in lockstep. It is both a metaphor and probably a double entendre. And they will get rid of the filibuster, and they will pass a federal ban on abortion. And I am willing to bet any individual out there any sum of money that that will be the case. I don't know if it'll happen in 2025 or 2026, but if they control all three branches of government, that is what will happen. Make no doubt about it. They know this is incredibly unpopular right now. They know that if people understood that even these exceptions for rape and incest and the life of the mother are there, they know that that is like an indicator of just how extreme normies perceive these bans. But they know that if people were to understand the implications of these bans and how irrelevant those exceptions are in terms of the practice of getting abortions, they would have a lot of electoral problems. They would have rathered this decision to have come down in next year on an, when there was no election. And so you're going to hear conservative after conservative pretend that this is sort of meaningless. It's not really going to change anything. Here is Mark Levin pretending that Roe v. Wade was not overturned, pretending that 11 states have not implemented their abortion bans already. I guess it's 10. There, the three are coming, and then the other 13 will wind up for it. Here he is because he knows this is going, it's wildly unpopular with the American people.
The decision is very simple. Here we have what's called the Constitution of the United States, not the tax code. It's not Obamacare. It's very simple. It's about 5,000 words, and you can look all you want. The word abortion is not in there, and it's never going to be in there unless they add to it. Here's the deal. Really, Roe versus Wade wasn't overturned. Roe versus Wade was fundamentally altered by a decision in 1992, Roe was 1973, called the Casey decision in Pennsylvania, which changed the trimester test and had the undue burden and viability test, which they basically stole from Europe and from other kinds of laws we have in this country. The Supreme Court has been shooting from the hip on abortion now for about half a century, and that's why I have all these cases keep working away.
I mean, he's just, you know, he's yammering away, but I want to try and translate what he's suggesting. Roe v. Wade passes in 1973. Its restrictions, it's allowing for restrictions upon this right, were a function of what trimester the pregnancy was in. That was changed in Casey, as he says, in 1993, to a viability standard, which is you cannot restrict abortion until 24 weeks out. And then states have a right to restrict abortion in certain respects. So the fundamental principle of Roe v. Wade was that it is a right that cannot be encumbered by the states except for in these circumstances. Casey simply changed the way they measured the circumstances. Then he says they're shooting at the hip. Well, I mean, Casey was Casey. Anything after 24 weeks, states had certain rights to encumber this right. They did not have the right to say you can get an abortion, but you can only provide an abortion if you have ceilings that are 65 feet high in your office, because they were clearly designed to inhibit someone's right for an abortion. This is all very straightforward stuff, actually. The court has for decades, well, hundreds of years, established certain guidelines in which a fundamental right can be abridged. You can't yell fire in a crowded theater. That is a test. There is a test that they apply to the First Amendment. Where does the First Amendment not apply? It's a right, but there are certain instances where that right can be abridged if it is in the state's best interest.
Half a century, and that's why you have all these cases keep working their way to the Supreme Court from federal district courts, and so all these pro-abortion groups constantly litigating to prevent the states from having any regulation whatsoever.
And pause it. This is not true. Groups have challenged laws that have been passed by states that are passed specifically to keep testing the limits in which they can abridge the right that the Supreme Court found. And it was not until the court became more conservative that these cases started to gain any grounds. Remember, the original Roe v. Wade, 7-2, and the majority of those justices were appointed by Republicans.
Saves from having any regulation whatsoever. And let's be clear about what this decision says. This decision says something really unique in American history. We have a very, very powerful body, the Supreme Court, saying we don't have any power. When's the last time you heard Congress or the president or the bureaucracy say, we don't have any power, so we're going to give this authority where it belongs, back to the people in the states? It's that simple. They're interpreting the Constitution. It's not taking anybody's rights away. It's not giving rights to anybody. First of all, God does that. But that said, there's 50 states for a reason. We're not a parliamentary system like in Canada, like in France. We have 50 states for a reason, 50 legislatures for a reason. So decisions can be made by the people in these states. The majority leader in the Senate is from New York. The speaker's from San Francisco. They don't get to decide everything in between the country.
Pause it. First off, Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer had nothing to do with Roe v. Wade. Second off, in fact, if they were to pass a statutory right for people to get an abortion, they could do that. So this is just garbage, because they know this is wildly unpopular and they're pretending it does nothing. The Supreme Court found this right in 1972 or 73, I should say. Just like they found an individual right to carry a gun in 2008. Just like they have determined that there is, no right to a tort if you to be a member of a class if it's arbitration. I mean, they do this all the time. The idea that they're just saying, like, we're powerless in this situation.
Isn't democracy great?
I mean, and then, you know, what the only logical conclusion, too, is that they can find that they're powerless when it comes to saying that people have a right to contraception. They're powerless in terms of saying that people have a right to marry people from another race besides their own. They're powerless when it comes to protecting two consenting adults being able to engage in any type of sexual activity they want. They are powerless as to whether, I mean, marriage is not mentioned in the Constitution anyways. Maybe you can outlaw marriage, period, in certain states, according to Levin. And we could go on and on and on with this. But they're playing games because they know it's wildly unpopular. And the bottom line is, we were talking about this in the office today. Who is it? Sitaraman? Was that the...
Ganesh Sitaraman is the professor
and,
from Vanderbilt Law School.
From Vanderbilt Law School. And he wrote about the middle-class constitution, right?
Yeah, the crisis of the middle-class constitution, why economic inequality threatens our republic.
And in many respects, there's parallels with today's interview. But one of the things he suggested was we need to have TVs or cameras in the Supreme Court when they deliberate.
Absolutely. Televised hearings. I think, like... not to get into the Heard hearing, but like the amount of attention that got, that should be on Supreme Court hearings too, and TV televising that would absolutely
absolutely facilitate. I mean, I don't think it would be as popular as, you know, Johnny Depp.
I think we'd be surprised at how popular.
But I think it would be very popular, without a doubt. Without a doubt. That's just one reform I think that would help at the very least get half the country that doesn't seem to pay attention to the implications of this court to pay more attention to it. Because the right certainly has been, and part of it is because they haven't controlled the court. But they methodically went forward with a project to put right-wing lunatics on there who have been pining for these changes for 40 years, and they did it. They won. They won. We will get into what the feds can do, what the White House can do about this ban later in the program. First, just a reminder, this is the last day you can get 25% off at justcoffee.coop. They are movement partners, the longest running advertiser on this program. They go back to Break Room Live days with Marin and I in Air America. If you have never tried Just Coffee, today is the day for you to order. You get 25% off your orders with the code MR25. 25% off, MR25. Try different flavors of coffee they have there. If you are already a fan of a specific coffee, now's the time to go buy that 5-pound bag because you will save 25% off it. So head to justcoffee.coop, C-O-O-P, justcoffee.coop, fair trade, coffee, tea, or chocolate there. Also, I know I've told you guys, but maybe you didn't hear me the first time. You know what the fastest growing crime is in America? Hey, you, do you know? No, of course you don't, because you're too young. It's, although... this crime rate has been going up, and I have gotten numerous letters from you and your sisters, schools, that there's been data breaches, because I'm talking about identity theft, and it happens to 1 in 20 Americans. And despite this, people get their identity stolen, they're shocked. One day, you're just logging into your email account, I can't get in, what's going on, someone changed my password. You start getting notifications, activity from your bank, your credit cards, crypto accounts. Maybe you get feelings of panic and fear and anxiety. Then you turns to shock and anger, and then you start blaming yourself. That's why I'm excited to partner with Aura, who is sponsoring this video. Aura is identity theft protection, fraud monitoring, a VPN, a password management system, and antivirus software all combined into one easy-to-use app. Aura monitors the dark web for your emails, passwords, and social security numbers and sends alerts fast, right to your phone and to email if they have been in some way leaked or breached or stolen. When it comes to fraud, every second matters. Connect your credit card and bank accounts. Get notified of any changes up to 4 times faster than Aura's competitors. Their VPN allows you to stay anonymous online by keeping your browsing history and personal information safe and encrypted. Their antivirus software, it's going to block malware and viruses before they infect your devices. Protect you and your family from America's fastest growing crime. Try Aura for free for 2 weeks. See if any of you or your family's personal information has been compromised. Start your free trial at aura.com/majority. That's aura.com/majority. We will put the links in the podcast and the YouTube description. We're going to take a quick break for about just a couple of seconds, and we are going to play the interview I did with William Forbath, Associate Dean for Research at the University of Texas Austin Law School. Joseph Fishkin, professor at the UCLA School of Law, authors of The Anti-Oligarchy Constitution, Reconstructing the Economic Foundations of Democracy. Be right back with that. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report. It is a pleasure to welcome to the program William Forbath. He is Associate Dean for Research at the University of Texas Austin Law School, and Joseph Fishkin, professor at the UCLA School of Law, authors of The Anti-Oligarchy Constitution, Reconstructing the Economic Foundations of Democracy. William and Joseph, Joey and Willie, thank you so much for joining me. I really appreciate it.
Our pleasure.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
All right, so let's start with just before we get into sort of the history of the changing perspective of the Constitution. Let's just start with where we are today, because in many respects, my sense is you have written this as a way of both acknowledging that a significant segment of our population, we'll call them left liberals, have lost a vision of a constitution that functions within the political economy, and that they must regain a specific vision. So why don't you, William, why don't you tell us first where we are right now?
We're in a moment which commentators rightly often describe as a second Gilded Age. Mounting economic inequality, which more and more Americans see quite vividly, is also mounting political inequality. For the first time in a century, Americans are, or almost a century, talking about oligarchy, right? What's changed, however, is that Americans on the liberal and left side of the debate and conversation no longer have a clear sense of how their forebears for most of our history saw the crisis of economic and political inequality and the erosion of a middle class as a constitutional problem, not just a social or an economic problem, or not just a simple political one, but a problem for and about the Constitution. And so what we have is a situation where on the right, they never forgot the old way of seeing the world in which the Constitution had a lot to say about our economic life. And they never lost the idea that they should promote their vision through politics and in the courts. What we've lost on the left and liberal side are two big things: how we do constitutional politics and clashes, and what they're about. On the left and liberal side, for good reasons, but now outdated, we fell in love with the courts. We fought the courts for most of the nation's history. The courts were not our friends, and they're not our friends today. But we still live in an important way in the sort of afterglow of the Warren Court. And so liberals and progressives made a dramatic and in many ways astonishing shift in mid-20th century America from fighting the court's account of the Constitution, to embracing the court against all critics. And we're very swiftly getting past that.
We're getting past it in terms of like our awareness that relationship.
Our awareness, but we're no longer, we've forgotten in the meantime,
right,
that it used to be that we fought about the Constitution. Everybody, the right, the left, the center, fought about the Constitution, not in judicial nomination hearings, but in ordinary party politics.
All right. And we will go back to that history, but before, and we will sort of go through that and when that was lost. But let me just ask you, Joey, in the sense that I think, you know, the conventional current contemporary vision of the Constitution is that it's a living document. And on some level, it feels like, despite the fact that someone like Breyer, for instance, very much associated with that idea, that the liberal left, to the extent that they believed in it, have not been practicing it that way. That it's the conservatives who have been both denying that it's a living document, but very much functioning as if it is.
Yes, the greatest practitioners, it's very ironic, the greatest practitioners of living constitutionalism in our time and the most successful ones have been conservatives whose whole mantra and political slogan is that they're originalists opposed to a living constitution. But what they knew is that political change can change the way courts interpret the Constitution, in part because you win presidencies and you win, you know, the right to appoint Supreme Court justices, and through that you can change the Constitution. The story of the relationship of the parties to the Constitution that Willie was outlining a minute ago is so important for liberals today to understand, because conservatives, really beginning with desegregation, it's sort of the aftermath of Brown, when candidates like Richard Nixon found that they could run on opposing what the court was doing and kind of build a political coalition around opposition to all the things that Warren Court was doing, from school prayer, which, you know, to busing to desegregate schools. And eventually by the late 70s, they added abortion. This centerpiece of conservative politics has enabled conservative majorities to change the meaning of the Constitution, to give us a Second Amendment that has become quite recently an individual right to bear arms, emerging from conservative movement through the Republican Party to the Supreme Court to our constitutional law. This is how our constitutional politics works and has always worked, but progressives and liberals haven't been engaged in it because we're still in this posture of telling courts, respect stare decisis, please don't backtrack on your old ruling so much. It's not a political body, the Supreme Court. Please keep it separate from politics. These assumptions, these ways of thinking, which come out of liberal opposition to the right-wing opposition to the Warren Court, you know, but they no longer work because we have a very activist right-wing court today.
I want to go back, and then we'll catch back up to this point. But it's in my it is as if there is a whole cohort of the country, and really, you know, maybe that's exaggerated because I'm not sure, frankly, that the vast majority of the country has even a perspective on the court that is this way. But I'm thinking in terms of the legal institution, and to the extent that everybody involved in the legal institution who is not in the Federalist Society, I guess is the way to say it, sort of believes in Santa Claus. It feels like on some level to me. And it's almost like you cannot wrench that idea that Santa Claus is not real or that the Easter Bunny is not real. And I'm curious as to how that develops. But let's go back to the sort of original perspective of the court that you outline. You walk us through sort of the, I guess the best way to do it would be sort of the pre and post Civil War eras, because they're fundamentally different. But let's just start in the pre Civil War era, I guess, in the first, you know, 80 years of our country. William, what was the perspective of our founders in terms of like what role the court would play and how sort of sacrosanct it was? You know, I say this as coming from multi-generations of attorneys. I'm not one myself, but, you know, it was as if it was the priesthood. And did they look upon it at that time as being this sort of church, or was it a little bit more profane?
That's a great question. I think it may have been a church, but a much more modest church. In other words, the founders had in common a fairly high regard for a well-functioning judicial system. But oddly enough, the one thing they were very skeptical about, with a handful of the most conservatives, you know, being exceptions like an Alexander Hamilton. But by and large, for them, constitutional law was just the opposite from ordinary law. So whereas they disagreed about the relative importance of federal versus state courts, but they all agreed courts had a lot of work to do. We didn't have a big administered state. Courts ran a lot of things. But the Constitution was thought to be, from a sort of long English tradition that ran, you know, along parallel lines, a very special kind of law that embodied principles and rights that the people enforced against their rulers, the governed enforced against the government. And in England, this took the form of mobbing and petitioning and protest and convulsive politics, which then settled down, but always with the Constitution playing this, even though it wasn't a written Constitution, it was a bundle of texts and ideas. And it played this special role, and the American revolutionaries embraced that and pushed it forward as their vision. So that the idea that the court had any role to play in enforcing the Constitution was already a dramatic departure, very controversial. In the early Republic in the 1780s, judges got impeached, right, at the state level when they tried to enforce their state constitutions over against legislation they thought unconstitutional. So judicial review was the new kid on the block, even when Chief Justice Marshall, you know, became the leader of the U.S. Supreme Court. And he slowly, brilliantly established the court's authority to have a part in interpreting and enforcing the Constitution. And then, and you just interrupt me if I'm telling you too much.
No.
But and then gradually he pushed for the court not just having a role, but a premier role. And he did not succeed. He did not succeed. He uttered those words, but for the next century and more, it was always, right, a contest in which what we now call judicial supremacy was generally the loser. And, so before we get to what the Constitution was about and how economic life figured in it, that's an important back, you know, kind of background.
Well,
that
because
judicial supremacy was never embraced until midway through the 20th century and that moment we talked about a moment ago.
And the absence of judicial supremacy means that what is supreme at that point is politics. And yes. And so that battle is being waged there. So let's talk about, Joey, if we can, this concept of if the Constitution is a check on the power of the government. Right. I mean, like fundamentally, that is it is to the power of the government. Another way of saying the power of the government is, and particularly at that time, is the concentration of wealth and power. Right. I mean, it has to be you don't have to protect the people from the government unless there is a concern that there is a concentration of wealth and power. So you could replace, on some level, it seems to me, that word government with the greatest amount of wealth and power. Maybe it's somebody wearing a crown. Maybe it's somebody who's amassed it in some other ways. And so the implication is that there should be some type of distribution of that power and of that wealth. And that was, in many respects, one of the prevailing ideas of what the Constitution meant.
Yeah, so from the early Republic on through, but especially when you get to the Jacksonian Revolution in politics, this idea that the Constitution gives us a reason and a set of arguments to block and to argue against legislating in ways that concentrate economic and political power. It becomes a through line. And you see that in most famously President Jackson's veto of the Bank of the United States, which, if you think back to what the country looked at that time, the wealth was concentrated in the Northeast in New York and in the cities, and all of these farmers in the hinterlands who voted for Jackson did not want the money to be concentrated in that way, and thought that things like this bank were going to just further this kind of oligarchic, wealthy, powerful concentration of power. Now, you mentioned at the beginning of this question the idea of the Constitution as a check against government, and that's exactly how President Jackson saw it in that veto, how I just described. But there was also emerging at the same time the beginnings of an idea that the Constitution actually requires things of government, that it's not just a limitation, but that the Constitution also puts in duties. This is what Jackson's opponents, the Whigs, thought, that the Constitution requires us to build a broad distribution of wealth, because it's a republic. You can't support a republic in a world of a few oligarchs and a lot of serfs. That's not a republic. And so if you're going to build that broad distribution of wealth, the two parties disagreed about how to do that. But this idea began to emerge, mostly on the Whig side, later to be adopted by the Republicans, that the Constitution imposed legislative duties on the federal government to build the kind of political economy and the kind of economic reforms and structures, whether that meant building the roads and the canals and all the infrastructure of the country, or whether that meant tariffs so that industry could develop in the country. There were constitutional duties about that were imposed on Congress. Members of Congress were arguing on the floor of Congress that the Constitution requires us to do these things because otherwise we won't have the kind of political economy that that our republic needs. And so that idea too, which is very different from how a court-centered view of the Constitution today looks, this idea of a legislative constitutional duty also comes out of this same early period.
William, I talk about this. This is like the concept of egalitarian constitutionalism, and there are three commitments that are associated with that. And it seems to me that it's not necessarily at odds with that idea that the Constitution is also sort of a check on government, because it's really government just happened to be the only concentrated power and theoretically the only concentration of power in our society at that time, but it could be conceived of as being against all the idea of concentrated power. But tell us about the concepts of egalitarian constitutionalism.
So we need to rewind for just long enough for me to say that in this pre-Civil War era that we're about to sort of depart from to go forward, nobody smells like a rose, to put it mildly. We don't have heroes. Jackson ain't no hero from any sensible modern perspective. he, you know, his coalition rested on slaveholders and the sort of emerging, you know, smallholders, working people. He appealed at once to white plebeian guys who felt oppressed by the emerging new capitalist world around them, and to the planter class of the South, who for at least a time were invested in having a national party that welded together the interests of slaveholding planters on the one hand and sort of, you know, working, white working guys on the other. It was a tragedy that, you know, what was most visionary about and most militant in the terms of a broad distribution was a broad distribution for white guys that was understood by those white guys to rest on both, you know, women's subordination and black slavery and the exclusion of black people from the community, political community. And the Whigs, you know, were the ones who nurtured some of the, you know, early anti-slavery thinkers like Lincoln. And eventually the anti-slavery thinkers in both parties coalesced in a new formation, which was the Republican Party. And let's be clear as well that there was massive concentration of wealth in the South as well. That's whom the Republicans, when they became the nation's first sectional party, gave up the ghost of a Southern Republican Party until they defeated the South and were trying to build up a black base. But for the time being, they were the sectional party, and they said, we must, right, ultimately dismantle slavery. At first, they said, we'll honor it where it exists in the states. We must bar it from the territories, and we must put it on the road to extinction. And what we must also assail is what they thought of as the slave power or the planter oligarchy. Those were their words. This isn't just Joey and my saying, oh, there's a word that captures what's going on. This is a word and idea that we found, right, everywhere in the archives and literature of, you know, every period, including this period leading up to the Civil War and its aftermath.
So I'm sorry to interrupt you, but to be clear, part of the impetus, I mean, I think, you know, I think people certainly, and we've certainly talked about this on this program, that people are aware that the anti-slavery sentiment both could be, you know, it could be abolitionist and it could still be very much racist in many respects. Like, but you're saying that the that
either way, they were hostile to the planters and they wanted to abolish slavery.
As a function, at least in part, too, because they wanted to undermine the oligarchic nature of it.
Exactly.
It's the economic power of being able to own labor, essentially, that was also part of the impetus to get rid of slavery.
And they owned the Congress in a special way because they were overrepresented, right? The three-fifths clause, the notorious constitutional provision that gave, you know, the Southern delegation, right, representation by counting slaves, three-fifths of persons, even though, of course, they had no vote. So the South, it's no coincidence that so many of our pre-Civil War presidents were Southerners or from Virginia. That was the hub of both massive wealth and an overbearing political clout, thanks to, you know, some of what was baked into the Constitution. So the Civil War, and this takes us back to your question about what are the three principles, where do they come from? The Civil War Republicans and the Reconstruction Republicans grabbed this anti-oligarchy tradition, grabbed this broad middle class as a basis for a Republican government tradition. And for the first time, a major party said racial inclusion, bringing the black slaves into the citizenry, is another equally fundamental principle for, right, a decent republic and a decent reading of the Constitution once we put these new amendments in it. And what we've forgotten is those amendments, in the eyes of these Republicans, did more than civil rights and political rights. They also, this takes us back to Joey's point, they also enjoined Congress, imposed an unduckable duty to redistribute land, to educate, to provide the sort of social and material bases of Black citizenship.
And just to remind people, this is when public schools were essentially adopted and promoted, and a lot of this stuff necessarily wasn't exactly executed in the way that I think a lot of the radical Republicans wanted. And there was a lot of negotiating that was unfortunate in the context of the 13th Amendment, let's say, that allowed for certain loopholes. And we see those loopholes, particularly in the context of voting, that come roaring back in what, you know, we call the Jim Crow era. But from a legal perspective, it also becomes sort of like the wind up, I guess, to the Lochner era, and as we are developing. So let's talk about that. And we should just say that those three precepts, just to be explicit about it, was to check on the concentrations of these trusts and these both economic and sort of political powers, to distribute the economic opportunities widely, and to extend that opportunity across both, you know, race and gender and other groups that were considered immigrants, I guess, on some level. And so we head into sort of almost like the Empire Strikes Back, I guess, era of the Lochner era. Joey, will you define what that means? Because this is a term that has come up on this program increasingly as we enter into a new Lochner era.
Yes.
Better to have a law professor put
it. Sure. Well, it's useful to bring some lawyers in, because one of the hallmarks of this political era that stretches around sort of the turn of the 20th century is the rise of the federal courts as an important player in political economy. So the story of this era, which we tell in a couple of chapters of the book, is one of massive economic transformation, right? This is the Industrial Revolution. You're having lots of workers in cities coming from the countryside. It's the rise of giant nation-spanning trusts, big corporations, the first great monopolies. And there's a populist and eventually progressive political movement on the other side saying these concentrations of power are too much. We need to tax this concentrated wealth. We need to create antitrust law to break up these companies that control, in some Western states, they control the whole state government, as in, you know, Montana that we talk about in the book. And the idea was, you know, the kind of axis of political conflict in America is shifting on a variety of fronts to being this conflict between the concentrated new large corporate wealth oligarchs and the kind of populist rebellion against them and in favor of the people. This is the beginning of the labor movement in the United States, and labor organizing was widely crushed by not just, you know, employers and their often quasi-military efforts to crush unions, but also aided by the courts. The courts in this period were staffed largely by judges who came from the kind of new elite corporate bar, which was just emerging at this time. And so really for the first time, the courts become a very big player in the fights about political economy that we're interested in the book. And this prompts populists and progressives to question in various ways the court's interpretations of the Constitution. Sometimes this takes the form of Article 5 constitutional amendments, right? So we have an amendment that says the court kind of very surprisingly decided that there couldn't be an income tax, and there was nationwide political organizing to put in an amendment, which we now have the 16th Amendment saying Congress has the power to do that. But there was also a broader political questioning of the authority of the courts and efforts to sort of through statutes and through politics to fight back against their vision of a kind of, this is to get back to your question, to get to their vision of a kind of contract and property rights are the highest rights constitution.
Let me ask you this, William. Was it, I mean, in retrospect, if you could have gone back and said, you know what, instead of pursuing a strategy of amending the Constitution to allow for an income tax, would it have been smarter at that time to simply say, no, you don't have the ability to limit the legislative that the right to have an income tax is up to the government at that point. But by pushing for an amendment to the Constitution, there is almost a tacit acquiescence to the idea that it's not in the it's not the right of the legislature to do this, that it's somewhere in the Constitution that an income tax can exist, and giving too much authority to the court at that point.
It's a great question. And reform advocates argued both sides of just the question you put on the table. If we think that this interpretation of the Constitution's provisions about taxation, wherein the court forbids Congress from enacting an income tax, is both off the wall as a sort of legal and interpretive matter, and motivated by, you know, sheer class antagonism on the part of the justices, then maybe we should just push right back. Others saying, no, let's instead pursue an amendment in order to, as it were, put an exclamation point on the authority of Congress to do just this, which stood for a much broader vision of redistributing wealth. So that already when the court teed up the issue, the dissents in those cases, right, said this gets the Constitution upside down, that the Constitution requires, again, this takes us back to one of Joey and Mai's, you know, in some ways we see as one of the most important points in the book, a way of thinking about our constitutional contests around economic life and political economy as ones in which there are two sides, and the side that we're on doesn't simply say, no, Congress has the power to do this, but Congress must do this and the court must back off. And so even in the dissents, there was a consciousness that we've lost, that the, not just the anti-redistribution side, which is the Lochner side, which is the side that struck down the income tax, but the pro-redistribution side saw their, right, principles as constitutional ones, that our commitment to equal protection, our commitment to a republican form of government, all required a new way of raising federal revenue, namely an income tax. So that it's quite a striking moment. And to come back to your question, I think no one on the side of the income tax amendment in the end thought they were legitimating the court. Right? They thought they were slapping down a court which had gone way too far and putting into the Constitution a commitment to a federal government that can tax wealth as much as it wants. Now, of course, that's going to be brought into question if progressives retake Congress and there's a wealth tax. You can count on, there are already many, right, old Lochner-era style anti-redistributive constitutional arguments being mooted, you know, in anticipation of a wealth tax, just as there are, you know, constitutional arguments being mooted about every element of the sort of broad progressive agenda.
And we should say the Lochner era, we just said, you know, for the sake of people should know that the Lochner case was really about, I think it was in New York State, limiting work, the hours of people working. Like, I don't know if it was exactly a 40-hour work week at the time, but it was
60, but you're right. We should have put that out there. That Lochner itself was a labor case. All the great cases, so many of them, of the sort of Lochner era and then the New Deal era, revolved around sort of a sort of wage contract. Could state lawmakers and Congress rewrite the, you know, put a ceiling on the number of hours, put a floor on wages, empower workers to bargain collectively? These issues that, to some extent, we've almost forgotten, our constitutional ones were at the heart of it.
And just for the sake of people who don't know, this was the court saying that there is a sacred right to the freedom of contract. But it also is ignoring at that point and saying that two parties can enter into contract. There should be no outside implications on that contract, like you can only work so many hours, or there's a minimum wage, or you have to be over, you know, the age of 12 or the age of 14 or something to that effect. And we should say it overlooks the fact that somebody's enforcing that contract. And so that contract's not that free at the end of the day, because the government, of course, enforces it. And, you know, if you have and there's economic coercion and whatnot. So there is no, it feels like, because this is going to be relevant when we start to talk about, you know, sort of what the prescriptive part of your book is. At that time, as FDR essentially, you know, has this big clash with the Supreme Court, and there isn't the same level of a tradition of reifying or deifying the court, so that asserting the "we the people" part of the Constitution is the most important part. And therefore, we, the people, via our elected representatives, can influence what the Constitution says, because that's the most important part. There wasn't a sort of like a culture to have to overcome at that point, was there?
It was just beginning, and it wasn't there yet. That's exactly right. There was the thing with the court that we think of today arises over the course of the 20th century. It arises through, kind of parallel to the rise of the First Amendment, which you might think, if you were an originalist and didn't know a lot of history, you might think, well, of course, that we've had a First Amendment since the beginning, but it didn't do much in the first century and a bit of American life. The court starts enforcing it in the 20th century. And there's this moment, I think we ended up going very briefly over this in the book, but it was very interesting for me to learn this little bit of history that, you know, the idea of building the court up as this sort of central temple-like oracular interpreter of our Constitution. This was the project of some important lawyers and judges, including President and Chief Justice Taft, who's the guy who got the Supreme Court building built with its impressive marble facade, and how everyone could look at that and say, wow, you know, the Supreme Court, as opposed to it just meets in the basement of the Capitol, how it did before. And he was building up that court because he wanted to build up the Lochner Court. He wanted to build up the court that would stop progressive legislation and labor laws and all of those things from happening. But of course, by the time the building was finished, that court also was gone, and FDR had won these resounding popular victories running in part against the court. And so the court, you know, things got a little quiet until the court reemerged as the defender of civil liberties, and then eventually in the Warren Court era, civil rights. And so that story, how the court that was this image of a temple and of a, you know, we should respect the great authority of these nine sort of priests, to use your analogy from before, which I think is a very rich and important analogy. That was an attempt to build up the Lochner Court, but instead ended up building up the Warren Court in one of those sort of weird twists of history. And yes, at the time that FDR was fighting with the court, there was only the beginning. You know, you had the beginning. There was there were lawyers, the American Bar Association. There were sort of rumblings of we shouldn't have politicians pushing the court around. And that certainly was a challenge for FDR. But on the whole, the idea that the big questions of constitutional political economy get fought out in politics was, I think, still mostly the view.
And Roosevelt forthrightly put it on the table. There's a kind of pseudo-history of the court packing plan that doesn't really look at the sources, which says it was a sly and unpopular move that badly injured the New Deal ever after. And every one of those things is at best a half truth, you know, or not even that. Roosevelt, after a little bit of slyness saying, I need to replace the old judges, quickly got right and said to the people, let me lay it out. And again, in one fireside chat after another, just as he had during the campaign and his overwhelming victory, he said, two visions of the Constitution are clashing. Only one can prevail. Ours is one which says government must be the equal and must government must govern over against the corporations that have miserably failed to pull us out of a depression. Government must govern and must enjoy, you know, power to regulate the national economy and redistribute wealth so that working people can buy the stuff they're making in the factories, or we'll never get out of the depression and we'll really lose our constitutional democracy to some kind of authoritarian regime. And when he won an overwhelming landslide, right, he and the New Dealers in Congress said that was a constitutional mandate to fight the court's kind of misreading of the Constitution. And then they had a debate a little bit like what you mentioned, Sam. And it's true. Some said, all right, we have an overwhelming majority. Let's amend the Constitution to make plain workers' rights, Congress's power, Congress's duties, redistribution, industrial government, and democracy. And Roosevelt said, we don't have the time. The amendment requirements will enable a small minority, just as they do today, to thwart amendments. And worse than that, the court's going to, you know, strain to read whatever we produce in the way of amendments according to its own reactionary lights. Let's go with my court packing plan. And then the court backed off. And headlines all across the country said, you know, the justices yield to, right, the combination of striking workers and a president who's called their bluff. And nobody, you know, and Roosevelt had a huge progressive majority who all agreed that the court had been, right, a kind of plutocratic outfit that was busting strikes and blowing up the New Deal, and good riddance. We, you know, would that we, you know, someday soon have that kind of majority. But at this point, everyone understands that the court is a player in a deep conflict over, you know, what kind of nation the Constitution promises.
It is, there's so much paradox here, though, it seems to me, because on one hand, like, I can just say as that, I think the broad strokes of history, certainly the sort of it is more and it's changing over the past 5 or 10 years in my estimation, but it has been more of like a heterodox opinion that what FDR did was not out of the realm of civilization. You know, I'm trying to think of like, I know I have interviewed people who have written about the failure of democracies. And the one thing they say was like, you know, what FDR did was wrong there. But in fact, what he was doing was actually part of a tradition that preexisted. And it was not anomalous. The problem is that on some level, liberals, civil rights advocates, sort of caught the car, as it were, and forgot why they were chasing it. And, you know, and created this entire sort of like edifice that the court is sacrosanct, to the extent that the entire legal institution, it seems to me, in 2000 was just like, how could they do this? And we're completely shocked. And who knows where things would have gone were it not for 9/11 following that ruling. But it seems to me like it is not hard to find people who are just appalled at what the court is doing, but still cannot bring themselves to the understanding that, like, this is a political institution subject to politics, because you can look at the Warren Court and you can look at the Roberts Court and something happened. And how you cannot get from the Warren Court, or frankly, the Lochner era, to the Warren Court, to the Roberts Court, unless it is being influenced by politics. And it just seems that at one point there was a far more concerted effort on the right as we got into the early 70s. Like, they figured this out, that this is an explicit thing, and they went on a mission for it.
Yes. And I'll just add one little postscript that I think is revealing to the story that Willie was telling about the court packing plan itself. So part of why some of your guests and, you know, some people who you may hear take the view of the court packing plan that they do is because some of the very progressives who were part of FDR's effort to confront the court, they became, you know, after World War II, they became liberals. We had some research assistants track some individual members of Congress, you know, let's find the people. They kind of retconned their story of the court packing, but they went back and changed it so that actually in their new view, court packing had been a really bad idea, because now we're all about defending the court.
Right.
And why are we all about defending the court now? Because the Southern Manifesto is out there and huge swaths of the country are, you know, having signs up saying impeach Earl Warren because of Brown. And if we want desegregation to happen, we need to defend the court. That became the view of liberals. And as you say, conservatives then became the ones who understood and practiced the politics of judicial appointment much more ferociously for 60, 70 years. And the increasing accuracy of their choices after you start creating groups like the Federalist Society that translate the polarized nature of our politics into a place for law students and future judges to get trained and appointed. Now you have the kind of full results on display. And it's one of these strange things for law professors and people who study this. I mean, political scientists have been saying for a very long time, the court is political. Look at the appointments process, look at who appoints who and how the results come out differently. And, you know, law professors, I think, have been clinging more to a view that surely on most questions, it's still an apolitical court. That's now, I think, breaking down, and everyone is seeing that the political scientists were right.
Is it breaking down? I mean, I were it not for the 2000 election, I don't think I would be sitting here. I had a completely different career trajectory and my relationship having had gone to law school for a year and coming from a family of lawyers and being told that it was an avocation and that the literally it felt like a priesthood and to watch the sort of intense denial on behalf of the various people within the institution of the law that this is not political. I mean, I still will have arguments with my father, if you're watching this, Dad, sorry, where he is talking about the judicial temperament or the qualities of the judge. And I'm like, this is not relevant anymore. This is, you know, I don't know that it ever was, but these concepts are I can tell you how they're going to rule, and it doesn't matter whether you perceive them as learned or not. It's just going to be how clever they are when they get to that ruling. And are we at the precipice of like where people understand, at least within the institutions? Because that's where it seems to me the grip has to be loosened before it becomes a question of politics.
I think there's some generational change on that front, but I'll let Willie take the question.
I think there's sort of there's an impossible task and there's a plausible one. The impossible task is to depoliticize a court which has claimed for itself and to some extent been given power over so much of the sort of deeply contested basic issues, you know, on our political agenda, all the way, you know, not just political economy, which is what Joey and I are working on, but also obviously so many other, you know, important issues. They're a court that enjoys that much power over such a broad swath of constitutional and fundamental stuff is always going to be political. And the mistake of many of our fellow kind of liberals, not so much progressives any longer, but the mistake is to think that somehow by restoring, you can restore the sort of institutional legitimacy in the sense of a strong distinction between law and politics and a neutral seeming, more or less craft, like what your pa talks about, a judicious kind of court, when it has that much power. So I think by contrast, there is indispensable work that judges and courts do that can fairly be described as, you know, they can do it in a craftswoman-like way. They can do it in a way that shores up the difference between what it is to interpret and apply the law and what it is to make policy. There are going to be profound policy issues all laced through it, but it's going to be more, you know, defensible and more indispensable if it only had much less power. And the question is, how do you get that? And how much does that? I don't think court packing is a great idea either, quite honestly. I think there are probably better ways of curbing the court, but that may be for another day. Point is that the court needs, that Congress, right, needs to reclaim authority over much of those and own it. And that requires also parties and a progressive party that owns it, right, and says, this is better for the court. This is like a little bit like FDR saying, I'm saving the court from itself. But how you do it is a tricky business.
Well, I mean, I started this interview by telling you that, you know, we're pre-recording this, and today, you know, we heard from a couple of different professors about the Fifth Circuit decision. Which, you know, could very well be if the EPA case in front of the Supreme Court now doesn't do it. We could get the things like the non-delegation theory or principle or rule, depending on who you talk to, or reinstituted. And we could see the diminishment of the functioning of our government, you know, over the course of the next, 2, 3 years, 18 months, 5 years. So what's the sequencing? I mean, court packing is just simply a tactic, and it seems to me it's a political one to say, this is me ringing the alarm. Joe Biden has refused to do that. He had a commission that supposedly was looking at questions of reform, and it could not have been more anemic and less indicative of the problem that we're facing. What do we need to do? And is this something that you can do without any type of elected political power?
No, it's something that you could do through elected political power. I think the first thing to do is realign progressive and broader liberal, democratic, left, whatever politics against the court. So that's where, you know, some of the work that you do, and that you do by telling everyone about what's going on in the Fifth Circuit that otherwise would be, you know, the subject of only like lawyers knowing about it, matters. Because the first thing we do is align politics in such a way that people understand that they should vote for Democrats who want to change some of the rules, who want to take some power away from the courts. Democrats who want to, you know, I mean, one of the very heartening signs so far for me this early, you know, election cycle is that you see a lot of Democratic candidates for Senate saying, "I'm for reforming the filibuster." You know, that's not a constitutional issue, but it's a very similar, you know, you need to have a Democratic Party that is focused and aligned toward dealing with the problem of an out-of-control court, and that requires setting up a politics that is very unlike how politics has been for the last few years. I mean, if you look at the 2016 polls and you ask how important is the Supreme Court to your vote, among the people who said it was not at all important, you know, Hillary Clinton trounced Donald Trump among the not at all important group. So, you know, we got a lot of work to do.
And work on, forgive me, Joey.
Yeah, go ahead.
You just to sort of widen the lens without getting deep into, you know, the details, Congress can pass laws that take power away from the courts to do certain things to the administrative agency's decisions.
Including the
Congress
Supreme Court.
Congress controls the jurisdiction of the federal courts. The Constitution sets some limits, but there is a great deal of room within those limits for Congress to push back against a lot of these decisions, including, I don't think the non-delegation doctrine is right around the bend, but it could come back, and Congress will have to push back. And that will be a bitterly fought battle because you know, a great many portions of the you know, big business and small are perfectly happy with a radically diminished regulatory state. But it's a battle that the Dems can and should win. And it's a battle that Congress can do, not through court packing, but through sort of fine-tuning the jurisdiction of the federal courts in various ways that will make a big difference. And if the court then overturns some of those measures on whatever kind of, you know, made-up constitutional grounds, then take away the court's jurisdiction.
And the idea is to, I guess, heighten this contrast so that you begin to educate the public as to what's going on with these things. Mm-hmm. I have a feeling, mm-hmm. You know, in some respects, the issues that aren't necessarily or I mean, I shouldn't say that the question of Roe v. Wade doesn't affect the political economy. It does. I mean, I think everything does on some level, but it is certainly the threat to the regulatory state. And the administrative state, I think, is one that's going to get a lot less attention than right. Something like a reversal of Roe v. Wade.
But reversing Roe again is bold congressional action.
Right. And it also.
I mean, not reversing Roe, reversing the undoing
reversal.
Of Roe.
Right.
Reinvigorating and reviving Roe, you know, will happen both at the state level and perhaps at the national level. But the broad strokes idea here is for lawmakers, state and federal, to embrace again their role as you know, as the sort of primo interpreters of the Constitution.
Well, it's a fascinating argument. It is not a moment too soon, sadly. William Forbath, Joseph Fishkin. The book is The Anti-Oligarchy Constitution, Reconstructing Economic Foundations of Democracy. We'll put a link to that at majority.fm. Maybe we'll have you back, sometime later this year to see how we're doing on that accord. It is, I think it really does articulate something that I think, you know, particularly the left in this country needs to understand, that relationship of the court within the political economy. And it is not enough to wish this institution away. It exists, and it needs to be seen as another lever and a just simply another political player that is on some level sensitive, albeit less sensitive than others, to political pressure. Thanks so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Thanks so much for having us. This is great.
All right, folks. Hope you enjoyed that. We're going to head into the fun half. Just a reminder, it is your support that makes this show possible. When you become a member, you not only get the free show, free of commercials, but you also get the fun half every day that we do it. Oh, I should also say, correction, made a mistake. The Just Coffee promo code MR25 for 25% off any of the justcoffee.coop coffees runs until the 30th. So it runs Wednesday's the 29th, Thursday's the 30th. And that microphone is not on yet. So it will go to the 30th. So it's justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MR25 for two more days, and you will get 25% off. Great time to try some new coffees. Again, you can support this show by becoming a member at jointhemajorityreport.com. In the fun half today, we will have what looks like we're going to do a special interview with our in-studio guest today, who just broke the microphone. Okay, all right. All right. Matt, what's happening on the... What's happening in the Matt Leckie and Media Universe?
Yeah, this afternoon after MR, there's going to be two videos premiering on the Left Reckoning YouTube page. The first one is our talk this weekend for patrons, Andrew Perez on the dark money behind the Supreme Court. And also C. Derek Varn later after that one on the right wing. We talk go for about an hour and 20 minutes on the right wing, so with C. Derek Varn. So check those out. Go subscribe to us on YouTube.
And just one IM before we head into the fun half. Dear Sam and the rest of the MR crew, absolutely love the show and the work you do. I've been particularly impressed with your coverage of the January 6th hearings, as well as your take on the crap canning of Roe. So I finally decided to become a member because I can't take this woo effery any longer. I'd love a show far, but I'd love it even more if Sam could keep his quivering word hole shut for a couple of seconds before and after so I can clip it for my own leftist needs. Left is best, left is poggers. So here you go, Woods Brew 42. Thanks for joining, and you get this. All right. 646-257-3920 is the number. We'll be right back for the fun half. 3 months from now, 6 months from now, 9 months from now, and I don't think it's going to be the same as it looks like in 6 months from now, and I don't know if it's necessarily going to be better 6 months from now than it is 3 months from now. But I think around 18 months out, we're going to look back and go like, wow.
What? What is that going on?
It's nuts.
Wait a second. Hold on for a second. The Majority
Report. Fun. Emma, welcome to the program.
Hey. Fun.
Matt.
You.
Fun. What is up, everyone?
Fun.
Nomi Key.
You did it.
Fun.
Let's go, Brandon.
Bradley, you want to say hello?
Sorry to disappoint everyone. I'm just a random guy.
It's all the boys today.
Fundamentally false.
No, I'm sorry. Women's...
Stop talking for a second. Now let me finish.
Where is this coming from, dude?
But, dude, you want to smoke this... 7-8?
Yes.
Yes.
Is this me?
Is it me?
It is you.
Is this me? Hello? Is this me?
I think it is you. Who is you? No sound. Every single freaking day. What?
what's on your mind.
Sports. We can discuss free markets and we can discuss capitalism.
I'm
going
to go for
that. Libertarians.
They're so stupid, though.
Common sense says, of course.
Gobbledygook.
We fucking nailed him.
So what's 79 plus 21?
Challenge map.
I'm positively quivering.
I believe 96, I want to say.
857-210-35-501.
One half.
3/8.
9/11, for instance.
$3,400. $1,900.
$5.43 trillion.
Sold.
It's a zero-sum game.
Actually, you're making me think less of
it. But let me say this.
Poop.
We call it satire. Sam goes, satire.
On top of it all,
yeah.
My favorite part about
yeah.
you is just like every day, all day, like
yeah.
everything you do.
Without a doubt.
Hey, buddy, we see you.
All right, folks.
It's just the week being weeded out, obviously.
Yeah, sun's out, guns out. I don't know.
But you should know.
People just don't like to entertain ideas anymore.
I have a question. Who cares?
Our chat is enabled,
wow.
folks.
I love it.
I do love that.
Look, gotta jump. You gotta be quick. I gotta jump.
I'm losing it, bro.
2 o'clock. We're already late, and the guy's being a dick. So screw him. Sent to a gulag?
Outrageous.
Like, what is wrong with you?
Love you, bye.
Love you. Bye-bye.